We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. The Hornets have just completed a winning homestand, so we decided to bring on Jerry V, who can give us his immense wisdom and tell us how this one homestand proves that the Hornets are now going to be a playoff contender for years to come, right? Is that right, Jerry?
Well, you hope one day that we're discussing on a daily basis about playoff seeding and matchups and roster enhancement, but it is what it is. You know, you are what your record says you are, although there have been some nice moments and some game-to-game improvement by some guys, but it is what it is, and you can't take your eye off the ball to see what needs to happen in this offseason.
So I have just one question based on advanced stats. I kind of wanted to ask this for a while. The Hornets, if you look at their differential, and it's very similar to what it was last year, they lose games by about 3.5 points per game. And every advanced statistics I've read says 3.5 points. You're going to be a team that wins about normally 32 games. It doesn't seem like it's that far to go from 3.5 to 0 and become a team that could, at least win half your games. Are the Hornets actually that close, or is there some fool's gold there?
I think there's fool's gold. I don't think they're that close yet. You can look at that, and then you have to look at margins going in and what cut it to 3. What was the margin, let's say, going into the fourth? Was it ever a double digit? Then you'd have to really go back and extrapolate matchups, health of opposing rosters, et cetera, to tell you that. Some of the stats can be misleading. That's why you need to take some stats and couple them with a few other stats to get to the truth of it. For example, I'll give you one basic example. You can look at defense and say, well, defensively overall, they defend well, they don't give up a lot of points. But then you'd have to look at pace, where they're number 30 in the league, they're the slowest. Then you can go back and take another one and say, well, what about their offensive rebounding rate? It's pretty decent this month or this season. They're doing a nice job with that. But then you have to go back and say, well, they still don't take enough shots or make enough shots in clutch moments. They don't get to the line enough. So they can be misleading when you try to pull out and get to the bottom line of a few issues. The average thing, if you're beating a team by 5 points or more per average, or 5 to 7 points more per average, that's considered terrific. So the three, misleading.
So one of your theories.
Pop your bubble. I hate to break your heart and pop your bubble. But the line on the bottom of the page still says reality.
So one of your theories, which I wholeheartedly agree with, is you measure yourself against the top teams in the league. Before tonight, the Hornets had six games in this homestand, all against playoff teams.
Right.
They went 3-3, including a very surprising blowout win against Denver, who was on a 16-game winning streak, I believe, at the time. What did you see specifically from this homestand that gives you some hope, and what do you see that still needs to be fixed?
Well, I saw some glimpses of lack of consistency, but when you saw the consistency offensively with the old basic ball player movement, there was a crispness to it where the ball wasn't staying in one spot on the floor. When they had the good ball movement countered with good player movement and getting to the lane and running their counters, they looked good doing that. And when they just wrecked Denver in that regard, they haven't been consistent doing that. But when they do it, they're a nice team to watch play. They did that when Vasquez was out. Robbins is at the point, and they had to do that out of necessity. Although Vasquez played well tonight in a nice win against Cleveland, that was nice during the wins. What I don't see enough of still is the club isn't rugged enough on people. A big piece of evidence would be how they almost seem shy in displaying any type of physical play against LeBron James. The other night, I sat and watched that a few rows behind the Hornet bench up close, and I was devastated by their lack of assertiveness against LeBron. And I know he's a great player, but there was almost, almost a timid factor. So some moments of nice ball and player movement, some moments of the crisp offense that came out of that, shooting the ball decently when it mattered, and also there were times where they were stringing positive plays together consistently. And by that I mean you make a jump shot, get a defensive stop, or miss a jump shot, get the offensive rebound, put back, reset, or a score, or draw a foul, get to the line, the willingness to throw that second, third, or fourth pass, et cetera. Those were nice moments. Defensively, they had moments where they looked legit, but when people started to go to their premier personnel, there's still the defensive breakdowns of, wait a minute, who rotates, when, where, and how, who's got them, do you have them, that type of confusion. And then the slippage that still exists in their defensive rebounding, still not consistent enough, but that's a personnel issue more than a skill issue.
So just talking about that rebounding particularly, Michael and I are pretty much on board with, you know, if Amina's not here next year, I mean, we won't shed any tears. I'd love to see him develop, but I don't expect him to. But of all the players on this team, except for Davis, he is the only one who really shows a lot of talent at rebounding at his position. And for a small forward, he's a fantastic rebounder. So if he goes somewhere and we replace him with someone who has more skills offensively, can actually take a jump shot, can spread the floor, get to that corner three, what happens? I mean, if they don't make too many other upgrades, like if their front court remains largely the same, is this like going to be one of the worst rebounding teams in the league?
Well, yeah, they need to enhance that, because you look at Smith, you look at Jason, who can rebound the ball. He's a nice offensive rebounder. He can come up the lane, shoot the basketball, and he's a runner, and that's fine. But there are moments where he's away from the basket that can hurt him. But I still like him as a guy you need on the roster. You look at Anderson, who can shoot the three. You need that, but not the guy that's going to bang and crash it consistently. They need a rugged frontline player that can battle along the baseline to help Anthony Davis and others. You need someone down there. So there's a fear there as far as your overall rebounding. Because if you can't defensive rebound the ball, you're not going to be very, very successful unless you're just a flat-out, mind-blowing offensive team in the open floor that's up-tempo. That's why I believe, fellas, that this summer is a critical summer for a couple of reasons. Number one, upgrade personnel. Rolling out of that is that you have to give a sign to everyone that your approach to roster enhancement is deadly serious. And that will send a very positive message to your fan base, your ticket buyers, and your overall fans that watch games on television or listen on the radio. So your overall fan base. And that movement has to take place. So you're hoping that it starts with enhancing your offensive ability to score and then your ability to rebound the ball if you can't possibly score on that play. So those two areas are critical. I tie in the ability to score is that point guard position that I've been harping to you guys for months and months and months about. So I think it's a critical offseason to address those two areas. And rebounding is right there in capital letters.
So obviously bringing in more talent would be great this offseason. But as you've often said, you know, right at the end of the season, coach meets with the players, talks to them about what they want to see them work on this year. We have a couple of fringe guys on this roster who, if they make
right.
a couple of significant leaps, maybe they could be quality backups on really cheap contracts for years to come, or they could very well not even be on the team next year. What would your advice be for Darius Miller and Brian Roberts to work on individually this offseason?
Well, with Brian Roberts, because his age at 27, right? He's a little older, so he's going to have to come in here and continue to work on his playmaking. I like him in the open floor. I think he has decent vision, shoots it properly. I like him as a backup, not as my starter. So I tell him, you go out and you play against the best guard competition you can all summer. Continue to work on your strength and your playmaking and running that pick and roll and attacking the lane like you did, but fine-tune it a little bit. So go out and challenge yourself against people, and you'll have a shot to stick on my roster, because I think his game is pretty much at that ceiling point or leveling off. He can fine-tune a couple of other things. With Miller, work on that handle to get your shot, because you got that tweener position type about you. Work on that handle, add a bounce to your game. Work on shooting the basketball, your catch and shoot, add the bounce to it, and work on your defensive play because you're in a tweener position. You have to come back next year, and let's just say I'm the GM, okay? You have to come back next year and show me that I have to find the spot on the roster for you because you're going to do something extraordinarily well. What will that be? Are you going to be my defender? Are you going to be a legitimate shooter for me? What will that be? That's what those guys need to do. Guys that don't have that A-caliber talent have to come back and show you they can do something exceptionally well that warrant a spot on the roster, scoring, rebounding, or defending. Or, you know, if you can do two things exceptionally well, of course you're going to be a terrific player. That's what I'd like to see him to do. It's possession to possession, show me something, a blockout, a stop, a pass, a score. Show me your enthusiasm and energy possession to possession, and I could possibly find the spot for you.
So, I mean, and that's one of the things we spent a lot of time podcasting this season talking about different players and whether they're going to be back next year
sure.
or they're going to not. So just take the last time the Hornets were in this position where they had gotten a superstar, they were building around them. That was Chris Paul.
Right.
And he played one season with the Hornets, and the following season, there were two players who stayed with that team and played in the top 10 minutes. So I'm not talking like Brandon Bass, who's a rookie at the same time.
Right.
But he had Desmond Mason, David West were the only players who stuck through those first two seasons. They completely turned over the roster in Chris Paul's second sophomore season.
Right.
Do you expect that to happen with this team as well? Are we going to next year we're going to be looking at a team that maybe has three faces that we recognize and everybody else is different?
Yeah, I think you're going to see some turnover because you got to get better. You're going to see turnover. You can't score. You're not fast enough or quick enough. You got to get rugged. You can't keep going. You know, I hear guys saying, oh, we get a lottery pick. If you keep thinking that way, you have to keep this in mind. Your coach is going further into his contract. He's still teaching. Then you have to get another young guy ready to play. And does that hold back your team and your ability to win? So that's why I said what they need to do this summer is they need to make credible moves to show that they're legitimately pursuing success. And I think that they'll do that. But, yeah, I think you'll see turnover because all you have to do is look at the statistical breakout and you look at your record. You've won, what, 27 games? 26, 27 games.
26.
It is what it is. And you got to get better. Your basketball skill set isn't high enough. And you have to address it. Because if not, next year can be difficult once again. And now you're putting your coach on an island and adding pressure there. They need to get some presence next year of guys that are already in the league that know how to play. Because there's too much. It's the second youngest team in the NBA. And you look at the progress of those young guys and how much have they come along. Aminu has shown some stuff, still not rugged enough. I wanted to run out on the court the other day and go to him and go, why are you so soft here? I mean, what is going on here? And you can't change personalities drastically. And as I watch that team up close, I'm looking at this team and I'm going, I wish I could use the real salty language to explain it. You don't have – I'll be blunt. I can do that on the podcast, right?
Absolutely.
You don't have enough – I wanted to say you need a sort of a – I don't want to say a badass type of personality. So I'll run it down to you need ruggedness. There isn't enough ruggedness. And that's the type of player Monty Williams was. You know, he scratched and clawed, set the hard screen, banged and battled. Sometimes I watch this game and this team – and I said, it's like watching a stick of butter in the sun. Other nights,
wow. They
show some of it, but it's not consistent enough. Where is the hard screen? Where is the body check at times? And I'm not referring to cheap shots. Where is the body language that displays a rugged attack on the ball? Where is that? Now, young guys like Davis and all, they'll acquire that as he gains his strength and all. But it needs a personality injection of that type of a player or two that can help these young guys. And you need to start making that move now because your developmental process will drastically slow down if you don't inject more basketball talent on this team and some personality to go along with that talent. Now, personality, I don't mean you walk in a room, you're shaking hands, because there's some incredible gentlemen on this team. They're some of the classiest guys in the league, no doubt. But I mean on the floor, ruggedness.
So let me ask you, Jerry, how good does that player have to be in order to really get the respect in the locker room and change the culture? I mean, could you get a sixth, seventh, eighth man who has that kind of personality, a Reggie Evans type? Or do you need somebody?
Although Reggie's too old. I mean, Reggie's too old right now, I think. I don't know what he's got left, but I see what you mean by personality. Yeah, he could be a bench guy who has the respect of people, who's earned his bones, and he's paid his dues in the league. And every time he's on the floor, he leads by example or in practice. Absolutely. You hope that it's one of your leaders. Because the key thing in the NBA, if your team buys into what your two top players want to do, that's the key. Because then they become the key voices in your locker room. You got to get guys that buy into what your key guys want, your two key guys. They had alpha dogs in Chandler, Chris Paul, and David West, especially with Chris Paul and David. Now they lack that alpha dog on the floor. The perfect world, that guy or guys would be your two key players, and then everybody falls in line. But right now, because of the youth, there is a question of who do I turn to that directs me and leads me and can get on me other than the coach when things aren't going well or if I'm not playing well.
All right, let me
that's an absolute requirement at the professional level in any sport. It's an absolute roster requirement. And anybody that tells you that that's not true, you need to give me their name, number, and Twitter account.
So let me follow up with that. I'll cut Ryan off here real quick. Let me follow up with that. So it sounded like maybe an indictment possibly of Eric Gordon. So let me give you three scenarios.
Sure.
Either A, Eric Gordon will be one of your top two players, but he'll never have that kind of leader, brass balls type of mentality that you need to lead your team. B, the Hornets just have to rid themselves of, Eric Gordon and go out and put somebody else next to Anthony Davis that could have some more of that? Or C, do you think it's possible that the Hornets could bring in and or develop two players that exceed Eric Gordon's production on the court, and then he could be a quiet little soft mouse, third banana type of player? What route would you take if you were Dell Demps, knowing Eric's personality and the fact that you need some alphas to lead the team on this roster?
Okay, and let me clarify. When I say alphas, you don't need crazy guys that bang their heads against the wall, scream and yell chairs, but just authoritative guys that demand a presence and are willing to go and talk to teammates what's required of them. And I'm sure they'll do this in the offseason with Eric Gordon. They'll sit down with him and they will ask him, here's what we see. What did you see? How do you think you did? Because here's what we think. My thoughts about Eric Gordon are this. While I like his game very much, Eric is not the type of personality, doesn't appear to be, that will make – I would like to see him make more demands with the ball. I would like to see him become more assertive on when he wants the ball because his game could warrant that. He needs to be coupled with a type of player on that floor that'll bring that out of him. I think Eric, this is my observation only, needs the presence of a strong personality to be with him and to keep him fired up, to keep him going, because he's a terrific talent. Can they find that? I think when you go, well, can we find two guys and develop them? Well, how long is that going to take you? And how long are you going to wait if you're not winning games? You have to bring guys in that have that and that can come on the roster and have that presence, because they'll be able to sit down with the player and go, hey, look, I've been in this league. I played in this league. I know what it's all about. You know, you need a mentor type presence eventually in a locker room that can tell guys that have made that journey. Even if it was an older veteran that's been in the playoffs and played well, who is a backup guy that you can go to, eventually you got to have that peer pressure. With Gordon, it's going to be determined if he stays or goes. He's your only break the playoff guy. He could be your best offensive guy because you need that off the dribble game, but he needs to be coupled with the player that he's on the floor with where he can feed off all of that. And right now they're simply too slow. They just lack that. So you need him as a player, or you need him as the talented player that will allow you to get another player if you choose to move someone or keep them. But I'm going to work on the premise he's here, and then I want to fork on the premise to go, let's find someone that can fuel him. Because, and that's what I think is lacking.
So my final question for you, Hornets are going to clearly be pretty high in the lottery this year.
Yeah.
Would you prefer them getting yet another young guy and having to turn them into something, regardless of who it is? I mean, it can be any of the guys who are coming out of in this draft. We're not talking specifics. Or if they could trade that pick for a dependable, solid, not star, but solid veteran player at any position.
I don't like
which would your preference be?
I if I can get a lottery pick and he's another young player, I see what I can get for that lottery pick. Because, again, how long are you willing to wait to develop another player? Let's say you go big. People are coming up to me going, oh, we love Knowles. We love him. He's big. He's young. Okay. How long are you going to wait? Is that going to slow your progress to win? How long do you want to go of being a non-playoff team? Because if you bring him, what is your greatest need on the floor? Scoring. Guys that can handle and score the ball and get their own shot, which you don't have. Unless that's addressed, I don't care if you bring in King Kong stomping buildings down. That's from a movie reference. It won't help because he won't get the ball and he won't be a factor. You need to score. And you need wing and guards that can do those basketball things. So I personally think that you need to have guys that have NBA experience, a couple of guys with NBA experience that can come in and play, unless there's a particular young player in the draft who's a Chris Paul talent, come in and help. But I don't see that for what their needs are, not yet.
And then my last question just centers around the point guard position for all his might and try and yelling and enthusiasm and effort, which nobody will ever question. It's hard to envision Gravis Vasquez really being the floor general on a championship contending team. And it's even harder to envision, him as the floor general on a team with Anthony Davis, because you see a young guy that should have 10 to 16 points a game in the paint alone and on fast breaks, and Vasquez just can't seem to get him the ball there. What specifically are you looking for, for your point guard moving forward with this team? And feel free to throw in any specific types of players or guys from the past, anything like that. But what are you looking?
I'll refrain from the temptation of getting me a Chris Paul, because he's the best point guard in the NBA. He's one of the best, Irving and company. But a guy that, and I watched this very, very carefully, and I like Vasquez as a player and a person. I chatted with him the other night in a tunnel. He walked over, introduced himself. We had a nice little chat, and I like him as running my second unit and my guard that can play the two and the one if need be, okay? But in watching the game, when you watch the ball advance, when the Hornets secure a rebound and they're coming to their offense and they're on the push, right now they can't put pressure consistently on opposing defenses, forcing defenses to make very quick decisions in the open floor. They lack that attack mentality from that attack quickness from that position. You want a point guard that has some more open floor speed, who's a decent enough scorer to keep people honest. But you need to enhance your open floor quickness, and that'll translate, you hope, into quicker off your pick and roll. And then that quickness will transfer itself over defensively. That needs to be upgraded. Also, you need another wing attacker who in the open floor can handle and run, short clock guy, ISO guy, chaotic moment, give it to me, I'll put it on the floor, get to the rim and make a play. That basketball skill set needs to be addressed. So those are the two I'm talking about. You know, and what I'm going to eventually do is put a little wish list together when you look at free agents and who's on trade bait, who's out there that fits that qualifications. But those are the basketball physical requirements that are needed right now. You need that. You know, you've got to have that. I watch the games closely, and I say that situation right there that I'm watching, if you had a better push on the ball, that 3-on-1 would have remained 3-on-1 and not become a 3-on-2 or 3-on-3. Or that particular situation right there, your point guard would have been to the circle, pressure on the defense, makes the scoring pass or the finish. You got a deuce where you don't have to reset. That's desperately lacking.
So, I mean, here's a follow-up to that for me, though, is how hard is it to find a guy like that? So, I mean, we'll have point guards on the market this summer,
sure.
Like Teague out of Atlanta, Brandon Jennings, of course, out of Milwaukee. Are those guys able to do that, or are we talking about guys that there's not a lot of them available? Those are the ones like, you know, Paul and Deron Williams and Derrick Rose, guys who are locked up, or can you find that?
Well, you can find guys that are quicker. You can find Jennings that's quicker and some others. If you can't, you're in the dilemma, like what will you pay Vasquez next year? But if you can't upgrade your quickness and scoring at the other wing position, if you still have Gordon, you've got to get another scorer on the floor that can offset that. If you can add wing punch, catch it on the floor attack, that can help offset what you, let's say, you weren't able to address at the point. But it's fascinating when you watch games and watch the advancement of the ball in the play and how quickly they can get into an offense or early offense and an attack mode. So you have to find that. Now, if let's say you look at one of your scenarios, and because you got to play crisis management in your meetings, and you go, okay, let's say we still have Vasquez. Let's say he will be our point guard. What can we do to help him? Well, get another wing player that can score the ball, that can handle. Get some more punch. So when the ball leaves his hands, it's going to a guy that can get you. And if you can do that on both sides of the floor, Gordon on one, another guy on the other, it helps disguise some of his offensive lack of quickness. It won't defensively, and that's another issue, because that lack of quickness is also hurting you defensively, and it's killing your bigs because they're playing help position all night long, and that hurts you. But the scenario that you'd have to take if you can't address the first one, you need to address that athleticism and scoring at your wing position, small forward or a big guard.
All right. Well, when you get together your wish list, I want to see it, bring you back on here to discuss it because, yeah, we definitely have a couple of our own, and it's going to be an exciting offseason, a new start, Pelicans basketball starting next year. So
big offseason. This is a big offseason because a statement will be made, will have to be made to send the signal. Because now that the team is here and the fans want to get around this team, you can feel it. The fans want to get around this team and become an NBA fan. You got to send them another statement that addresses a desperate basketball requirement so they can start to see, couple this with Davis and what we have. You've got to come back a better scoring team and more quickness. You must. Pope Francis told me the other day when I asked him, two needs for this club from where you sit. And he said, quickness and scoring. And when he said that, I said, we got something here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping we see the white smoke with the next point guard that we get.
Right. If it's white smoke, you know they got quickness. If you see more black smoke, it said, forget about it. We're still not going to be quick enough.
Wow. All right, Jerry, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
It's always a pleasure to be on Hornets 24/7. Anytime, you know that. Thank you for calling very much.
Thanks. Jerry.
Okay, guys.
So I haven't spoken to the Pope recently, but I just basically come to a conclusion with this team. In this offseason, I don't care about anybody on this team sticking around except for three players on the entire roster. Next year, in my top eight rotation players for this Hornets team, there are only three players on the entire roster I would like to see in that top eight, and all the rest of the players can go away. And, I mean, all three of the guys are big guys. Anthony Davis, Jason Smith, Ryan Anderson. Are you on board with me on that?
Well, I mean, just so people are clear, I don't think you mean exactly – I think you mean go away for upgrades, not just throw them away for nothing.
Well, I mean, I don't really care how many of them go away. Just they need to be replaced. I don't. Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't. Honestly, you say upgrades. I don't know if there's any way you could trade them away and get anything back for half of these guys.
Right.
But they need to go away and be replaced with a different basketball player who will probably, without much effort, be better than most of them.
Yeah. I mean, some of the things that I do like is, you know, you look at Brian Roberts and Darius Miller and Lance Thomas's salaries is at the very least, I've got end of the bench guys that I'm happy with. And yeah, I'm with you. I'm really concentrating on, okay, I got Davis, who's going to be my number one long-term, Anderson, probably my number three, and Jason Smith, my number six or seven. I'm going all out to grab, you know, my two, my four, my five. And then, you know, I've obviously seen that Dell could bring in and Monty could develop end of the bench guys with really no problem at all. So really my entire off season is answering the question of is Eric Gordon my number two? And if not, I'm going to explore the draft, the trade market, free agency, whatever it takes. I'm going to find my number two guy, you know, basically at absolutely any cost because I'm going to be able to fill in the rest between Dell scouting them out and Monty developing them.
Right. And you bring up like Brian Roberts and Darius Miller. And I mean, I got to say my comfort with Brian Roberts, I mean, compared to like what the second podcast of the season where I said he could be gone right now and I'm happy. I think Brian Roberts is a perfectly decent backup point guard. And I never thought I would say that about him.
Yeah, I mean, I would not be miserable at all with a bench next season of Roberts, Rivers, Miller, Anderson, and Smith. And, you know, to me, that bench, and you've got that bench locked in at, you know, a cheap cost. But then that basically just leaves me with Davis as the only guy in the starting lineup that I'm really happy with. So that means it's on the Hornets this offseason to plug quite a few holes. But if they can, you know, I would be very happy with that five-man bench, or even putting Rhino in as a starter. That four-man bench, you know, wouldn't be horrible to me.
Right. And so, I mean, that's just like what I meant when I was talking to Jerry. I mean, we spent so much time talking about Aminu and how, you know, Roger Mason is a perfectly good veteran player and he can come in and help you out. And we like seeing him out there playing. And it, I mean, all of those guys, though, not impactful. In the greater scheme of things, they're not. If I had Brian Roberts on the team next year and he was my backup point guard and getting like the ninth most minutes or the eighth most minutes, I'm not going to be upset. But I don't think that you should do anything at all with any of those guys, anybody other than the three that I mentioned, where you say, I'm okay, I've got that guy. Every single one of them you should be looking to upgrade, or if you can, even if you drop them for nothing, let them go away. If you can find another player who you think will fit other needs, just let them go. And I mean, it's one of the things you got to do to be able to get from 26 wins to 40 plus wins. Every single position's got to be upgraded.
Yeah. I mean, either positions upgraded or, like Jerry V was saying, just roles changed. I mean, this is drastic, but Gravis Vasquez doesn't need to be upgraded if LeBron James is brought in at small forward. So,
right.
So I mean, yeah, is there a small forward out there who, between he and Eric Gordon, you know, they could create 90% of the offense and Vasquez could be a spot-up shooter? I don't really see anybody. I mean, the best small forward out there is Iggy. He's not coming. You know, you have a couple of mid-level guys. In the draft, you have Otto Porter, who's, you know, who's good, but he's not going to be able to come in and create from day one. So, yeah, I mean, if somehow you could get a small forward who could create and then also defend backcourt players, then you could leave Vasquez where he is. But, you know, barring something significant like that, the point guard position needs to be upgraded, and, you know, the center position, for as nice as it's been to see Lopez, you know, play better than we expected, that needs to be upgraded either by Anthony Davis putting on 15 pounds this offseason and taking on that position full time, or another guy being brought in to play next to him like a Pekovic.
All right. So going outside of that, we did have four games this week that we haven't talked about. The Hornets, of course, beat Denver and Cleveland tonight. Hey, it's Sunday, and we actually had a win. Should we have a little celebration? Yay!
No, I mean, we wanted to. It's Sunday is not about wins and losses. It's whatever we want, they do the opposite.
Right.
So back in the day when we were actually pulling for victories, they would break our hearts. And now, you know, have a chance to lose to a team like Cleveland, get back in the discussion for, you know, a top three pick, and they go out and beat them pretty handily. But, yeah, that Denver game was absolutely shocking to me. But really what I took away from that game more than anything is I just had an even healthier respect for Miami's 27-game winning streak, because you just saw the pressure of the streak and the exhaustion, you know, just really got to Denver. That team looked absolutely awful. In that game, and they just looked exhausted. And the Hornets actually looked like the quicker team in that game, which we know isn't true. But the 13-point, 18-assist performance from Brian Roberts, I mean, most improved player?
Right. He is the point guard of the future for the Hornets. So here, this is the one thing I took away from that Denver game, and I'm really disappointed you didn't set me up to be able to lambast you for it. I fully expected to get on the podcast and you to say, well, you know, they beat Denver, but it was because Denver just lost it. It wasn't because the Hornets played well. Honestly, in that game, the Hornets played really well in that game. All of their guys looked like they were determined to stop Denver's streak, and it was probably the most energetic I've seen that entire team.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, no, the Hornets played well for once. You can't play that card.
No, they definitely played well. I mean, they played well. I don't know how much of it is repeatable. I don't know how many more games we'll see Darius Miller score 16 points on 7 shots.
Right. But I just felt that they went out and they won that game. Previous blowouts we've seen, it's just felt like the other team just didn't have it going. They weren't trying as hard as they were. But this one, it felt like the Hornets stomped on them and then kept going.
Yeah.
And that was good. It felt nice to have that, for me at least.
It reminded me a lot of that first Clippers game that we won in L.A., with the exception being that Denver wasn't hitting their shots too.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, 14 of 25 from three. Great ball movement, getting up and down the court with the fastest, most athletic team in the NBA. I mean, I was really happy. And like I said, you come out of this game and Brian Roberts has 13 points and 18 assists. If any of the national media were watching, I don't think anything could hurt Gravis Vasquez's most improved player candidacy more than having Brian Roberts come in and rack up 18 assists in that game.
So, Brian Roberts is great in that game. I mean, and honestly, I'm going to say this, it's stupid. I know it's stupid. But just watching him over the last, like, week or 2 weeks where he's gotten significant minutes, I almost would rather see him as a starting point guard. And I'm not saying he's, like, better than Gravis Vasquez overall. Just the penetration, seeing someone penetrate into the paint with quickness, and not once he gets into the paint, him being so precarious, because like when Vasquez manages to get into the paint, he's basically already off balance. He's usually fighting a defender who's on his hip. He's got to take that shot or hope for a wild dump off. Roberts can get into the paint, and he's not always off balance. I mean, he is sometimes, but not always. So you actually have the chance that when Brian Roberts gets into the middle, he could pull it back out if things shut down on him. And Vasquez, you don't get that. So if it was kind of a switch where Roberts was now the starting point guard and Vasquez was the starting guard off the bench for both spots, I'd almost prefer that at this point. It's never going to happen because, you know, Vasquez has been starting all year. But I don't know. Did you feel that same way or not?
I think the offense flows a lot better, but I will say that I think ever since that 25-shot game, Vasquez has been playing differently. It sounds like him and Monty had a very stern conversation after that game. Yeah. Vasquez has been playing differently. I mean, even today in the Cleveland game, you just see Vasquez finding Anthony Davis, you know, more in that game than I remember him finding him all year. So, I prefer Roberts' skill set. I think that Vasquez has a little bit more intelligence and guile, but really I don't care. Just get somebody to run the pick and roll with Davis, get him the ball in spots so he could start to develop. Really doesn't matter to me which guy that is, but in this game Roberts was incredibly impressive. But like I said, I do think that game hurts Vasquez more in his MIP candidacy and maybe in his trade value than anything else, because you see a journeyman who's been playing in over in Europe could come out and get 13 and 18. So my question from you, Roberts or Miller, give me your percentage. Both guys have a team option for about 800 grand next year. What's the likelihood that either or both are on this team next season?
On the Hornets?
Because
of the cheap price tag, I expect both of them to be here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the only other part of this game that I was really interested to see, and it's partly because of your weekly piece, there's the, I guess not trio, it's the quadrio? I don't know. What is four? The four wings of Denver, one of which is probably going to pry loose. So there's Chandler, Wilson Chandler, Corey Brewer, Iggy, and, of course, Danilo Gallinari, who's probably not going anywhere, of course. When I watched this game, I felt like Wilson Chandler had a way better game than he did. Did you feel like, I mean, Brewer, I loved his energy, and Wilson Chandler both, like, seemed to be attacking all the time and seemed really impressive. But when you go and look in the box score, I mean, both of them had fairly poor games. Did you see either of those guys in this game and think, yeah, I think even if he was making a few more of those shots, he'd really help my team and I want him?
I mean, this game would be kind of unfair. Not, again, the Hornets did play a good game, but I feel like this was Denver's worst game in the last month and a half. I think they were just absolutely exhausted and weighed down by the streak. But I'll agree with you. I saw Chandler all over the place, and it felt like he had a bigger impact than the stats show at the end. And quite frankly, I mean, you could make the argument that Ty Lawson and Wilson Chandler have been Denver's two best players over this streak and over this past 6 weeks. I mean, Chandler has been amazing, basically since the All-Star break. And he was a guy that I thought they were going to look to move in a salary dump this summer, just because, you know, they've got Lawson's extension kicking in and they're probably going to have to re-sign Iguodala to a big number. But the way he's been playing, I think they hold on to him, and I actually think they just let Corey Brewer go, and out of all these guys, he would be the one most likely to be a Pelican. I still like what I see. He's not going to rebound like Aminu, so that's what I'm saying. If you get a guy like Brewer, you're going to either have to change some positions or keep Davis at power forward and bring a guy like Pekovic in. But he moves the ball really well. He pressures the ball, which is, you know, the Hornets need to do. They definitely need to start turning teams over more often. But I would just hope that, you know, for people trying to make an evaluation on Brewer or Chandler, they watch more Denver games than this one, because this wasn't the Denver team that I've been watching the past couple of weeks. They just looked exhausted and run down. But I'll still take Brewer on my team. But I'm with you. I'd probably prefer Chandler.
Okay. Yeah, just something about the way he was attacking the basket made me grin. I thought it was really, he was very good.
Yeah, he's been turning on as of late. And then we go to, the Clippers come in, Chris Paul comes back, and he didn't hold his feelings back for a certain General Gravis, basically mocking to the fans and some of the commentators and those on the floor, jokingly calling Gravis the Hornets' savior, and that Chris Paul didn't need to come back next year because we already had our savior in Gravis Vasquez. Well, Vasquez goes 0-2 in 28 minutes, no points, 4 assists, 2 rebounds, 5 fouls, and Chris Paul just wasn't having the greatest shooting night, but really just controlled the pace of the game, and the Clippers really took off in the fourth quarter. But I will say, I do believe that Anthony Davis won the matchup between him and Blake. What were your takeaways from this game?
Yeah, so Vasquez, honestly, I was shocked when I looked in the box score and saw he actually played 28 minutes. Because I felt like he was in foul trouble all the time, and I was expecting to see like a 16-minute game or something like that. So in the previous, I don't think it was the game before, but maybe the game before that, where Chris Paul said to a reporter that, oh yeah, Gravis Vasquez should be an All-Star. And you asked me afterwards on the podcast, do you think Chris Paul is big sarcastic? Well, I think the answer has been. has been pretty clear here. Paul, when he gets a guy who will talk back to him, he gets downright vicious. And in this case of Gravis Vasquez, that's a good thing for Chris Paul. I don't always think it's a good thing for Chris Paul. Do you remember, you know who I always terrified of playing whenever Chris Paul was in one of his moods to be a vicious bastard on the court? Jose Calderon. who is like one of the least scary basketball players in the world, but Chris Paul would make him furious. And Calderon's biggest problem is he's not assertive and he doesn't try hard. And he would get out there after Chris Paul and would just, I mean, he'd be screaming on the court and pointing at Paul and his face be contorted with fury, and he'd play awesome. And, I mean, so, I mean, maybe the Hornets should just trade for Jose Calderon and make sure that we play Chris Paul every single night.
Hey, he will be a free agent.
I know.
This offseason, so.
It'd be an upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to have a pass first point guard who could get the ball to Davis in his spots. I mean, in all seriousness, if we get a guy like Marcus Smart or Michael Carter-Williams in the draft, I definitely wouldn't mind Calderon coming in here and tutoring a guy like that. But, yeah, it was a game where, I mean, to be fair, Vasquez was coming back off of an ankle injury, and he wasn't 100%. But, I mean, he was healthy enough to play, and he decided to play in that game and just got utterly embarrassed. The Hornets, for the most part, were in that game through three quarters, actually made, you know, a good effort of it most of the way through. I really think the Clippers, I think they peaked earlier in the season, and now, you know, they're setting up for a one-and-done in the playoffs, and I just still think, I think so many people just assume Chris Paul is going back, and I'm not saying he's going to be a Pelican, but this is a guy who always talks about winning is the number one priority. He's seeing his friends starting to win rings. I don't know how you re-sign for 3, 4, 5 years with a team that, you know, is taking step backward. I just don't. If the Clippers are one and done, I think it becomes a fascinating situation with Chris Paul, and why I think the New Orleans chance would only be 5-10% at that stage. You know, a chance is still a chance, and I think it'll be really interesting this summer.
Yeah. I mean, let's just put it this way. I think I said this before. The Clippers made the same mistake that the Hornets did when they had Chris Paul. They went out and signed a bunch of pricey veterans to really stupid contracts, and these guys are going to keep continuing to slip. And if Chris Paul sticks around, that's what he's going to get to live with. I mean, they have Blake Griffin. I would say Blake Griffin is better than David West. They have DeAndre Jordan. I would say he's infinitely worse than Tyson Chandler. And really, in the bigger scheme of things, how is Caron Butler that much different from, say, Morris Peterson? Or Chauncey Billups from Bobby Jackson at this point? Or Lamar Odom from, you know, a hole in the wall? This team is... doesn't have any young talent. Jamal Crawford is probably the best player on this team I haven't mentioned. And good Peja is as good. The Peja, that one season we got a Peja where he was good, isn't any worse than Jamal Crawford is this year. So, and all of these guys are going to fall off that I listed. There's not a single guy on there who I expect to be better significantly than they are now. And one of the bigger problems is Blake Griffin's basketball IQ has vanished. The man has turned... I mean, I was so impressed when I first saw him playing basketball because he played with him himself. He played near the basket, around the basket. He didn't take dumb shots. He could drive and pass extremely well. And then we get to see games like this where he's like, oh, I'm Jason Smith. I'll take 18-foot jump shots. And he can't hit them. He's terrible. And the entire team just backs off of him. I mean, if the entire opposing team is asking you to take a shot, you shouldn't be taking it. And Blake Griffin, that's not in his head. He thinks, I'm a superstar. I can do anything.
Yeah, and I mean, the only guy I will say that has a chance to get significantly better, ironically, is stuck right behind Chris Paul.
Right, but so, I mean...
They're kind of stuck. Do you trade him to get better pieces around Chris Paul, but then risk losing Chris Paul and having nothing at point guard? Or do you hang on to Bledsoe, but your only young, talented guy is stuck behind the guy that you're building your franchise around? So, yeah, I was surprised that they didn't move Bledsoe at the trade deadline, because as you see, they're starting to give minutes to Chauncey and Willie Green in that spot. And as the playoffs come along, they're going to give it to the vets. I was shocked that they didn't move him, and now they're going to go into the summer. And do you risk moving Bledsoe on draft night or before the season kicks off, and then Paul could leave you? I don't know. They're in an interesting situation, but I think they're one and done. I think best case scenario will be very similar to last year, where they eke out a first round series against Memphis and then get demolished in the second round. But all this talk of Lob City and this being the new young team, I mean, there's something about Chris Paul's game that it's weird. He's just so good at controlling the pace of the game that it actually hurts his team in some way. I mean, in some ways, just because they become so predictable and so dependent on him. If I were him, I would go somewhere or look to bring in somebody who could really, you know, run the offense at least 30-40% of the time as efficiently as I can. And, you know, that's just not happening in LA. So it's going to be interesting. But with this game, I mean, I wasn't wowed by the Clippers. Ryan Anderson, the Hornets, said the Hornets came out flat, and they kind of did, but there was a spark in Eric Gordon that I hadn't seen in a while, and that, you know, that along with Anthony Davis's second half was something I could take away from this game and be excited about.
Yeah, and you mentioned Anthony Davis outplaying Blake Griffin. There's not any question there. I mean, he was better defensively. He was better offensively. Anthony Davis was a better basketball player out there. But I've already mocked Blake Griffin for his clear deficiencies and shot selection and other issues. So I guess Blake Griffin did shoot better from the free throw line than Davis did.
Yeah, which I am starting to find a little weird. Davis has gotten worse as the season's gone on from the free throw line. I think if I had to guess, I just think it's him getting used to getting beat up and fatigued in the NBA. I mean, you're talking about 1-2 games a week in college and only 30, you know, to 40 in total, and his body's, you know, a little fresher when he's at the free throw line. Now I think he's a little beat up, and that's affecting him a little bit. I'm not worried long term. I still see him as a 75-82% free throw shooter for his career.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not entirely just downhill. I mean, if you go through his month to month, it's 77, then 81, then 55%, and then back up to 78%. And this month he's shooting 72%. So, I mean, that's not a – he'll figure it out. I'm not worried about it. And I'm not worried – earlier in the season, I was worried to death by his mid-range jump shots. It still shouldn't be his go-to shot. I'm not uncomfortable with him taking it anymore.
Yeah, that, and there, it only happens maybe 2 or 3 times a game at max, but they're starting to get him some post-up possessions. Mm-hmm. He's passing well out of it, and he's got a turnaround jumper. I still haven't seen him back a guy in or really go baby hooks, but they're at least a conscious effort to get him the ball in the post more, so I'd like to see more of that over these last 8 games or so.
Okay, so next game. Miami, do you want to talk about the Miami game?
I mean,
was there anything that we learned there other than that they're a remarkably athletic team and the Hornets are not?
I mean, LeBron James is the best player on the planet, but even in warm-ups, he's not going to, you know, hit that well, you know, as he did. He was just on fire. I mean, there was one point in the game where LeBron had 28 and the Hornets had 27.
Yeah.
You know, you ran into a team that's way better than you are, that just had their streak snapped, is, you know, angry about that, and on top of all of that, the best player on the planet, the one part of his game that isn't an ultra strength, if anything, it's average for his position, he's just on absolute fire from deep, so whatever. I mean, you know, not really much to take away from that game yet.
Yeah.
You're going to lose that game, so it was nice to have him in there and for the New Orleans economy to receive a little boost on that night.
Right. So then, let's talk Cavs today. Kyrie Irving, once again, just can't be stopped in the fourth quarter, but this time it didn't matter because the Hornets weren't going to be stopped either. So Kyrie Irving with 31 points and 6 assists. I will say in that fourth quarter, though, especially, you know, for when there was a chance they might come back, the Cavaliers basketball, it really was like watching Allen Iverson 76ers, except for the fact that Irving's actually, I think, finishes better than Iverson used to. So Irving's just a better shooter. But, I mean, he wasn't passing the ball. He received the ball on the wing, and he'd attack and attack and attack or just jack up a shot. No one else touched the ball for probably 6 possessions straight at one point. It was Irving, and that's it.
I mean, look at that roster.
That's true. I mean, I guess he's missing anybody who can really take any pressure off of him, is he?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I thought their best playmaker in that game was Luke Walton.
Right.
I mean, he had a couple nice passes, but yeah, Waiters is gone.
Is Waiters done for the year?
I mean, he's been shooting around, and he might come back, but, you know, it's not going to be enough to get Cleveland the victories. They need to catch back up to us, but... Yeah, to me, Cleveland's offense was bad, but that's just talent. Their defense was
horrendous.
Oh, my gosh. To see Vasquez come around to pick and roll at his normal Vasquez speed, drive down the middle of the paint, and everybody just watch him as he lays it in, like, that was unbelievable to me. So that Cleveland defense is horrible. They've packed it in. Congratulations, they're getting the third most ping pong balls. They had the third most last year and didn't help them out. So, you know, I hope it's worth it. But, yeah, that defense is beyond horrendous. And Byron Scott doesn't seem to care. He just does his typical staring out in space that we all know so well. So that was a game that, you know, whether Vasquez plays or not, whether Irving plays or not, I don't see any way that the Hornets could have lost that game.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife was watching it with me, and that rarely happens, for probably the first 10, 15 minutes of the game. And the game was already, I think, 3/4 of the way through because I watched it on tape delay. She's sitting there watching it, and she's like, the score is going to be like 12-7 at halftime. And I'm like, both of these teams are really bad defensively. Something's going to break loose at some point. And she's like, I don't know. And she looked at her phone and goes, oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, for the Hornets to score 36 points in a quarter, something's got to be terribly wrong.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, some good things, though. I think Brian Roberts had another very solid game. Ryan Anderson, of course, this was the exact guy.
He was amazing.
Yeah, I mean.
I loved his offense.
So much versatility. Anthony Davis running the baseline, running the break. I mean, I really thought in this game Vasquez made more of an effort to get him the ball than ever. Had that beautiful no-look in the lane. But I'll still say my favorite play in the game just because of the two people on each end was in the first quarter, which was horrific to watch. But Gordon drives the lane and makes a nice little bounce pass to Aminu cut in the baseline.
And dunks on the guy?
Yeah.
That was sick. That was a brutal dunk.
It was beautiful, but it just makes you like, why can't this happen more? And Gordon has 6 assists in this game. As Wesley Myers kind of said, he still looked like he was fumbling around a little bit out there. He had 3 turnovers, but I really do think he made more of an effort to get others involved. And, you know, this was one of his better playmaking performances. And that pass to Aminu really stands out.
Though he also had the worst play of the game, too, on either end of the court. And that was at the end of the first quarter when he comes running out the wing, catches the ball at the top and attacks down the middle, trips over his own feet. Falls over, loses the ball. They take it down court for a dunk to end the quarter.
Yeah.
That was I mean, I don't even know what he was going to do there. The hair pack in the middle of the paint. Anyways.
Yeah. I mean, there is still a balance issue there with him. There's still, you know, him just not as fluid as he used to be. But, again, another game I like from Miller, there was, you know.
Yeah, Miller's looking good. So when you put that missing piece up article about, you know, next Danny Green kind of things, I was kind of skeptical about Darius Miller. And I'm still skeptical about him defensively. I'm not sure how great he can be defensively. I'm not sure he's got the speed for it. But as a wing shooter, this guy's, and as an intelligent ball moving passer kind of guy, just as a support offensive weapon, he's got a hell of a lot of promise.
He does, and the intelligence part is what I love. And his final three of the game, he made two in this game. In the final one, he's just stationed in the corner, and he's just standing there awaiting the pass. And you know, Vasquez and Anderson are playing a bit of a pick and roll. And then Vasquez starts driving towards the baseline, and Miller's defender is watching Vasquez. Miller just kind of makes a, you know, slowly jogs out to the wing, gets it kicked out to him for a wide open three. It was something where lower IQ guys or a guy like Aminu just stands in that corner and watches. But Miller just made a slight little move, understands spacing in the game, understands, you know, how to react, and when your defender gets caught up watching the ball, just to make a slight move to get you open. I love every little small, tiny aspect of his game. You know, never expect him to be a star, but yeah, I could definitely see him getting solid minutes. If he's getting 12 to 15 minutes next year as an eighth or ninth man, I wouldn't be disappointed at all.
Yeah. Which is nice. Means that Dell can identify cheap wing players. Got to get him a second round pick.
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about, oh, I don't want to give Brandon Jennings all that money, or I don't want to give Pekovic all that money. But to me, if you could identify enough guys and underpay them, what you've got to do is you've got to get 12 to 15 guys under, you know, essentially $70 million. It doesn't matter how you do it. The Spurs underpay some guys, and then they overpay Steven Jackson. It doesn't matter how you get there, just as long as you have the flexibility and that, you know, you do get below that number. The fact that they have guys like Roberts, Miller, Jason Smith, Ryan Anderson, Anthony Davis, all severely underpaid, and, you know, hopefully we could add Austin Rivers to that list in the next year or two, means that, you know, if you've got to overpay to get something you really need in a Brandon Jennings or a Nikola Pekovic or, you know, a Luol Deng, whatever, you can't just look at that guy in a vacuum. You're building a whole team for $70 million, and the fact that we have all these guys on great contracts allows you to be, you know, a little more risky and aggressive in going after other guys on the market.
Yeah. So I don't have anything more about to talk about these games. We haven't seen what your take is on this particular tournament now that it's kind of, you know, winding down towards the end. Has there been any, here's what my take on the tournament actually has been. There isn't a guy in here who's going to be a monster difference maker, and you can tell just by watching them play in the tournament. I mean, the guys that are supposed to be good, they have really up games and really down games, and if they're going to do that in this tournament, don't expect them to come in and be a difference maker next year in the NBA, or maybe even for the first couple of years. Do you think, is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah.
Or am I being too pessimistic?
I don't buy that. Okay. Do you consider Andre Drummond both a difference maker this year and B, a guy you would love to have on your team for the next 5 to 10?
I wouldn't call him a difference maker this year, no.
I mean, for the minutes he's played, you don't. I mean, he's easily. I mean, I've just been reading Detroit blogs that already anointed him as their best player. I mean, he came back, and already I think today in like 26 minutes he had 15 or 16 rebounds. But okay, whatever. I still think he's. I mean, he's been a very good player. And then the second part of my question. Would you be very happy to have him on your team for the next 5 to 10 years based on what
you
saw?
Yeah. Okay. No, and I'm. But what I mean is, I don't watch these guys and think any of them are ready next year to take on any serious load for a team. Like Anthony Davis, when he came in, I didn't think he was going to like make this team a winner, but I thought he was ready to come in and be a serious starter and have a major impact on this team this season. I look at the guys that are coming out in this draft, and I think there are some guys in here who may be all-stars. But next year, and probably the year after that, I'd expect them probably to be at best a bench guy.
But how many guys from each draft over the past 5 years have you – I mean, couldn't you say that for any draft?
So if you're talking top five, you'd kind of expect guys who are in the top five to be able to come in and be at least impactful.
Really? I don't. I mean,
okay.
Do you think John Wall was impact? I mean, his team just kept losing. I don't know. I think you could look back at any draft in the past 5 years since it's been nothing but, you know, 19-year-olds and basically, you know, the guys who are making your impacts are the rare ones like the Tyreek Evans who already have the physical body. And then the older ones like Damian Lillard, but I don't know who would fit your criteria. I mean, so from last year, Kyrie Irving made an impact. Derek Williams didn't, Cantor didn't, Thompson didn't, Valanciunas, Vesely, Biombo, Knight, Kemba Walker. I mean, stop.
Yeah, well, that's a really crappy draft.
But I'm telling
you. I understand what you're saying.
I think you're remembering the drafts from 1993.
No, I'm not even saying, you know, I just my general statement is I look at these guys and I don't see any huge difference makers for next year. So if people are thinking that we're going to go into this offseason, sign one player or maybe two players and draft somebody and suddenly our team's going to be amazing, I mean, the only way that's going to happen is if those two guys we pick up are amazing and not the draft player.
Right. Well, I mean, anybody who thinks that the drafted player is going to make the impact next year just doesn't understand basketball. So, I mean, I go to the year before that, John Wall, Evan Turner, Derek Favors, Wesley Johnson. Cousins made a solid impact, but then Ekpe Udo, Aminu, Hayward, like even Paul George and Sanders, who are good now, weren't good in their rookie year. So that never, I guess I just don't think that ever happens. That used to happen when Shaq and Alonzo spent a couple years in college and then came into the draft, but I don't think that's what you are ever going to get. I think maybe there'll be one or two guys per draft class that'll come in and make a solid, you know, impact. And usually they'll be seniors. Like I could see CJ McCollum coming in and being almost like a Damian Lillard if he gets on the right team. You know, but I think when you're drafting in this day and age, when you're drafting 19 and 20 year olds, you're drafting for who you think they're going to be 2 to 3 years from now. And, you know, as far as that goes for what I've seen in this draft, I'm still, you know, I'm still happy about the top six. I know a lot of people are super excited about Trey Burke and even going as far as saying that they would take him at the top or in the top three. You know, I've learned over the past couple of years not to be very careful in giving critique to the guy that everybody loves. You know, earlier in the season, it was Vasquez. In the past, it was other guys. Trey Burke is a fine player. I've made the analogy to Terrell Brandon in the past. I thought Terrell Brandon was a fine player. But, you know, for people making the CP3 comparison or anything close to that, you know, my opinion is that you couldn't be more wrong. This is a, you know, a solid player, but there's so many things in his game that are not going to translate, that he's going to struggle with. I mean, if you watch him play, I've never seen a point guard make so many jump passes in a game, but he has to because he's not 6 feet. I don't care what he's listed at. He's 5'11", and you see he drives into the lane or even on the break, and he has to make a jump pass in order to get the ball through the lanes or even see who he's passing to. Like, he's a very nice, fine guy, a solid player, but I think the Hornets are looking for something vastly different at the point guard position, and even if they weren't, You know, I think he's the third and maybe fourth point guard taken in this draft when it's all said and done. So whatever, hate on me if you want. I just, you know, I see a lot of people running in that direction towards Burke, and I would just, I would advise you to maybe look at some other prospects if you want to know, you know, which way the Pelicans are going to go this summer.
And, of course, we'll talk more draft, but I do want, just before you get to go back and think about what you saw before, the tournament's still fresh in your mind, was there anybody in this tournament who you watched and thought, that guy's better than I thought he was, my impression of him is different now than it was before?
I guess if I had to choose one, honestly, I would say, and this is a guy that I said I would take in the later first round. Like, I think somebody's going to get a steal with this guy, but I think Jeff Withey is even better than I thought he was.
Okay.
Like, I knew that defensively he was a guy that I absolutely loved, and I thought that could come in and block shots. From, you know, just watching him again in this tournament, and when he actually did get the ball, I saw a lot more offensively from him. And, you know, I'll just say that I hope one of the smart teams in the Western Conference aren't the one that take him. I fear that they will, but yeah, he was a guy that I was watching him, and as I see the Hornets continue to win games, and I'm going, okay, the draft experts are saying Alex Lynn, Cody Zeller. Would I really, you know, if forced to take a big man, am I really that much happier with those guys than Withey? And obviously, and honestly, I wouldn't be. So he was the guy that stuck out to me just because he was better offensively than I thought.
Yeah. I fell more in love with Oladipo.
Well, yeah, see, that wouldn't be fair to ask me because he's...
You already had him really high.
Oh my God! I just,
and
yeah,
and I mean, I didn't watch him a lot during the season, so me just coming in, I mean, I was already looking at stat wise, and I think you and I had a conversation at one point where like his offensive rating and defensive ratings were insane at that point because he was on a really hot streak where it was like, you know, unbelievably good for any player in the history of college basketball, and he cooled off a little bit since then, but the guy is just I would take him number one in this draft.
It would be really close for me. I mean, because going full circle back to what Jerry V was talking about, you need a culture change. And that's why I kind of asked him, like, how big of a role does the player have to play? Because I think Oladipo comes into a team and he just has that kind of impact, that kind of, you know, Rudy impact, but with actual talent. Where guys are going to be embarrassed to not be giving their all because he just reminds me of a guy who's going to be diving into the bench, you know, in practice and, you know, just absolutely giving it his all in every single aspect of the game. He's the type of guy that I think just changes a culture. He's the type of guy that I think every time I read about what Demps and Monty want this team to be, when I read about how LeBron, you know, Monty saying that LeBron plays against boys and Michael played against men and the league was tougher back when he was like, I just can't imagine a scenario. I don't care who else is on the board, what pick the New Orleans has. I can't imagine a scenario in which Oladipo is on the board and Dell and Monty pass on this guy. I just can't. It's a question of whether or not they'll have a pick high enough to get him, but I'm with you. I mean, you can't watch that guy and not love him. He's always talking on defense. He's always making the right rotation. And that's, I mean, to be honest, what frustrates me a little bit with some of the people I interact with on Twitter and some fans is people, you know, fans are just so focused on the offensive side of the ball. And yeah, Trey Burke hit a 30-foot three-pointer to tie the game, and he is really skilled offensively. But defense is half of the game, and, right. You know, defense leads to offense, and, it you know, people just need to watch Oladipo and really appreciate him. I just absolutely love that guy.
And just think, if the Hornets get him, I could slaughter his name for years, and people could get so much entertainment out of that.
I would love to see Eric Gordon on Twitter just going nuts. Yeah, we got this Indiana guy. I can't wait to welcome my homeboy. whatever. And then 30 minutes later, the Hornets have traded Eric Gordon for the rights to this pick. And, you know, oh, that would make me so happy if Oladipo was the guy who came in and replaced him.
All right, so moving forward, the Hornets only get two games. Well, I guess if you count Sunday, three games. But they only got two games during this week. We have a long layoff until Wednesday where they're playing in Golden State. And actually, for the rest of the year, they have only two home games left on their entire...
Febreze experiment to prove Febreze can keep this
Febreze
car fresh.
Coming in for
Febreze. That's for what are you doing?
I'm on Basketball Reference, and they're throwing Febreze commercials at me.
Anyways, so Golden State and at Utah, and I mean Golden State is playing extremely well right now, and Utah, it's in Utah, which means it's going to be a hard fight because Utah has a great home court, and they're of course fighting for their playoff lives. So Golden State and Utah, Hornets going to take either of these games?
I mean, again, I'm still rooting for them to play well, but honestly, to get in the with this win today, to get in a position where, I mean, right now they're looking at best fifth or sixth most ping pong balls, and at worst they could still all fall all the way to 10th or 11th. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking the best they could do over these final eight for me to be, you know, feel secure with that fifth or sixth spot would be 2-6. I would be much more comfortable with 1-7, but, you know, other than maybe that road game at Phoenix, I don't see them being the favorites in any of these upcoming games. And that starts with Golden State, who's back to, I mean, they had a little dip there. They had a dip where people were saying, oh, are the Lakers, you know, maybe Golden State's the team that the Lakers catch. But they've got it going again as of late. I mean, they've won 7 out of their last 10. They had a blowout victory against Portland the other night. They beat the Lakers. It was only by 6, but they were up by upwards of 20 in that game. They're getting going again. They've been on a long homestand. This is the last game in their homestand, and they're actually going to have a longer layoff going into this game than we have. They played on Saturday, and they will have not played again up until that Wednesday when they play the Hornets. So I expect them to be completely fresh. And, you know, last time these teams met, Steph Curry just kind of had his way. A lot of the other guys didn't really have great games, and Golden State still won fairly easily. So I expect this to be, you know, a game in which the crowd is going. Golden State's going in the playoffs pretty hot. They're still rebounding the ball on the defensive end fantastically, and they're up to 40% on the season on their three-point percentage, which is just, I mean, that's phenomenal for an entire team who shoots that many threes to shoot 40%. On the season. So I could see this one getting out of hand quickly. But again, the matchup I'm going to watch is just Anthony Davis on David Lee. I've loved their battles throughout the season. So that's going to be my matchup to watch. But I expect Golden State to win this one going away, maybe by upwards of 15.
Yeah, I don't expect that to be a particularly great game for Hornets who are watching it, unless you're, of course, rooting for the tank. I mean, I'm starting to not like Steph Curry because he makes me worry. See, I have like this real, I'm one of those guys who there's always people who are like, I like watching great players, you know, play basketball. And as a theory, I like that. But when they're not on my team, I hate players turning into great basketball players because they're not on my team. And Steph Curry's doing that. Like, I always rooted for Steph Curry because there's a chance we might get our hands on him or something. But now there's no way we're ever going to get Steph Curry, and he's amazing. So I'm starting to – he's starting to slip into my resentful hatred area. So I hope he comes in and he fails miserably, and they still lose.
So, I mean, how do you expect this team to play in the playoffs? Because as you said with Jerry V, with point differential, I mean, this is a team that their point differential indicates that they should be closer to 39 and 35. They're actually 42-32. They've had their ups and downs throughout the season. I mean, it looks like they could get matched up with, like, you know, either Denver or the Clippers or maybe Memphis if Memphis gets hot. How do you think they match up with those three teams? Could they win a series and or make one really difficult?
I don't think they have a prayer. I really don't.
Who would you pick if you're Golden State? Who would be, out of those three, the team that you'd most like to see?
Denver.
Huh.
And I think just because Denver plays a fast, up-tempo game and are not the greatest defenders in the world, and I think that would be, I mean, basically Golden State's not stopping anybody. I mean, even with Bogut around, and he's actually somewhat impactful now. You would kind of hope you could outshoot them.
Yeah, see, I really think they could beat the Clippers.
Do you?
I really do, just because I don't think the Clippers are winning in Golden State. So to me, they've got to steal one game in LA. And like I said, with the Clippers, they just become so dependent on Chris Paul having, you know, a mega game. And the thing is with Golden State, with Klay and Steph Curry, Chris Paul's really going to have to play some defense and chase those guys around screens nonstop. You know, I saw Denver kind of wear Chris Paul out in their series by having Chris Paul really have to play a lot on the defensive end and then just have so much on his shoulders on the offensive end. I really think if I'm them, I want to see the Clippers. I think that's the team that they could beat. I think Memphis, I think Marc Gasol would just pick them apart. I think Denver, I don't think Golden State is going into Denver where they're 33-3 and winning a game there, but I can honestly see them beating the Clippers in a 3-6 matchup.
It's possible. I don't know. I just have a hard time imagining Steph Curry getting the better of Chris Paul overall.
Yeah, but he...
And I think that's what would have to happen.
I mean, who's... I don't think so, because, okay, if you had to rank the top seven players in that series, I think five of them are in Golden State.
I don't know if I'd say that.
Okay, you got Chris Paul, one... Mm-hmm. Steph Curry, two. At three, we could debate Lee or Blake, but let's just say those are three and four.
Okay.
Who are the next three best players in that series?
So I don't think Klay Thompson is as awesome as he's given credit for. So I wouldn't make – I mean
– How about Jared Jack?
Jared Jack. No, I mean, Jared Jack's – I think Jared Jack's – his reputation has become inflated a bit. I don't know. I would probably take Jamal Crawford next.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would take Jared Jack in a playoff series over Jamal Crawford. I don't know. I think that would be interesting. But anyway, I mean, with this Golden State game specifically, I see, you know, it'll be close in stretches, and then I just see Golden State being able to pull away just because they're not going to give Hornets the second chance opportunities, and, you know, eventually they're going to hit two or three threes, and before you know it, it's an 11-2 run that's made the game, you know, from 4 points to 13, and that quickly and in that short of a span would be, you know, the difference in this game. So, I think Hornets lose this one and then move on to Utah, who, as you said, are fighting for that playoff spot with the Lakers, which I've got to admit, I kind of want the Lakers to get into the playoffs just because I love watching them lose so much. I want to see them lose four more times.
I think I agree with that. And you know that once they start losing really badly, Kobe's going to have one of his meltdowns in the playoffs. So, I mean, and now that Andrew Bynum's not there to do a petulant, whiny bitch foul and try to hurt somebody, it's much more satisfying, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think I can get behind that.
Yep.
And Utah, I don't really care about Utah, so let them fail.
Yeah, I Utah's going to be up for this game. I mean, really, every team that we played on the stretch, save for Phoenix, has something to play for. Sacramento has been phenomenal at home.
Right. And the Hornets will be on the last day of that five-game road trip on a back-to-back, or the night before they'll play in L.A. really late.
Yeah, I think that Sacramento game is a definite lot. Like, I see the Hornets with a better chance of winning the Utah game than the Sacramento game. I don't see much of either. But, I really think this road trip, I think that Phoenix, who, you know, is really thrown in the towel, and maybe, you know, maybe in some kind of weird magnet energy way. I mean, the Morris brothers were so phenomenal individually when they were apart, and now they've come together, and it just hasn't worked, and Phoenix has been losing. But, yeah, to me, that's really the only game on this road trip that I think that the Hornets have a legitimate chance of winning moving forward. But, yeah, the Golden State game and the Utah game, I don't see. What do you see for Utah in this game and just overall? How would you assess their team this year?
So, I mean, Utah's, they're just so limited on the perimeter. In a lot of ways, they're similar to the Hornets, except they don't even have a Vasquez to go to. I mean, they really have no guards. Mo Williams is not that great. He's never been. He's more of a shooter than an actual slasher and scorer or a setup guy. And there really isn't anybody like that on that team. And this is one of those cases where, you know, every year there's like a big man in the college game who the writers say, well, you know, he could be really dominant, but his guards are terrible at getting him the ball. And this year it's been Alex Len and Maryland. Remember they said the same thing about Derek Favors when he was at Georgia.
Yeah. Georgia Tech, yeah.
Yeah, Georgia Tech. Same thing. I mean, if there was somebody on that team who could legitimately make it easy for Favors and for Cantor, I think that this Jazz team would be a whole hell of a lot scarier than it is. And if they can upgrade over the summer any sort of their perimeter game whatsoever, this team becomes a whole lot more scary going forward than it is right now. I don't know how they're going to do that, but, right, I mean, I don't fear them at all. And I wouldn't even be shocked if the Hornets won this game.
Yeah, like I said, I think they have a better shot of winning this game than Sacramento. I mean, Utah, they've reeled off some wins, but like in that Brooklyn game the other night, they only won because Randy Ford went 8 of 9 from three.
Right.
That's not happening take him out of the game and they go 2 of 8 from three between everybody else combined. Utah would have lost, and Randy Foy, I mean, he had gone through a cold stretch where, you know, he was shooting under 20% for about 3 weeks. So, yeah, they don't have any kind of consistency, completely dependent on one or two of their perimeter players just having a game that's outside of what their stats indicate they should have. Sometimes it's Hayward, sometimes it's Foy, on a random night it's Moe or Marvin Williams in that same Brooklyn game goes 7 for 9, which is a bit of an aberration. But yeah, they just, to me, they're like a kind of, they're almost like Sacramento in some ways, where I look at their roster and go, okay, those are some nice pieces I'd like to have, but they're just put together in the wrong areas. Like how Sacramento is overloaded at guard and wing, Utah is overloaded in the front court, and it doesn't all fit. It would, you know, it's almost like Sacramento and Utah should merge and come up with two separate teams,
right,
you know, where they split up their wings and their bigs, and there would be two solid teams there. But here, you know, it's just good. I mean, a lot of guys I would like on my team, but just mishmashed and not really fitting together well. So, yeah, I'm with you. If there's a game over on this road stand other than Phoenix that the Hornets win, it would be this Utah one for me, but I still see Utah pulling out an ugly close game, something like 92-86.
Yeah, I see a lot of hook shots from Al Jefferson flipping in over Lopez in that game, and I expect Utah to win that game too by about 8. So here's what I hope happens over the rest of the season, and this is my hope. This goes out to you, Jason Colmes, because I know this would make you inordinately happy, at least the very last tail end of this. The rest of this, actually, I guess, would make you sad because you want to win. But I hope the Hornets lose every game until Wednesday, April 17th, season closer. I have the game. I have the recap. And I hope it comes down to Dallas has to win that game to get into the playoffs over the Lakers, and the Hornets crush Dallas in Dallas to keep them out of the playoffs. Because Jason hates Dallas. hates Dallas. So that would make his day.
Oh, you're an evil man.
And then, of course, if we lose every other game, I think we have a really good chance of getting a nice top five pick. It'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's either five or six. It's basically, to me, unless we go on another improbable three-game winning streak, it's between us and the Pistons. Of course, the Pistons got to get me mad and lose by 1 point tonight.
I heard you groaning and moaning about it earlier.
Just always the case. They lead the whole game, and then they lose by one. But I guess that's what happens when you're putting all your chips for the final shot in the Charlie Villanueva basket.
Right. What is that?
But, I mean, Detroit has a much easier schedule than we do. I mean, they have Toronto, Minnesota, Cleveland, Charlotte, and Philly all on their schedule, along with some teams that, you know, aren't world beaters in Boston, Chicago, and Brooklyn, who, you know, in their last game in Brooklyn, maybe they've already secured their spot. So I think 27, 28 maximum is the magic number. I think if the Hornets get 27, they could probably be in the running for that fifth pick and no worse than six. But, I mean, it's a huge difference. I think people always think, oh, you know, why are you trying to go for the number one pick? There's no clear number one guy. And I think we've made it pretty clear that it's not about the number one pick as much as it is about, about making sure that you don't land outside of
the elite talent.
Yeah, I mean, I clearly think that there's six guys I would be fine with in a Pelicans uniform next year. I think a guy like Anthony Bennett could go to a team ahead of us, so maybe I would be okay with the seventh pick as long as Anthony Bennett went in there. That would push one of my six guys back, but you know, after that, I would start to get afraid, and that's when you're starting to look at the Alex Lenz and, you know, possibly the Cody Zellers. And I mean, Cody Zeller in that final game that he played in, he got his shot blocked six times in that game by a Syracuse team that doesn't have one guy on its front line that's going to be an NBA player. So it's not like when we saw Jared Sullinger having problems with Thomas Robinson and Jeff Withey last year. I mean, this is Cody Zeller just unable to get a shot over, you know, some guys who I don't see playing in the NBA. So to me, yeah, two wins maximum. I wouldn't be upset if we lost out. One win, I guess if I got to pick and choose it, I would probably pick Dallas at home, just to send the fans home with the final win of the season at home. But yeah, I'm rooting for the Hornets to play really well, but honestly, with as bunched up as these positions 5 through 11 are, I am not rooting for wins, and I'm not ashamed to say that.
Yep. So I don't know. I'm worried. I mean, there's a lot of teams that have been, you know, 1 of 9 in their last 10. So it's going to be tough. At least Minnesota and Sacramento have picked it up. So don't have to worry about them so much.
Yeah. I don't think we're catching. I mean, I think we could catch to Detroit, maybe. I don't think we're catching anybody else. But like I said, I wouldn't be miserable at six. Six probably means, you know, either Oladipo, Shabazz, or maybe Porter if his workouts aren't that great. But I'm fine with any of those guys. I don't want
to. You need to root for Michigan to have like some tremendous games here, so that Trey Burke might slip into the top six.
Yeah, I don't. I
don't see it happening.
GMs are not fans. I mean, they recognize potential. So we'll see, but yeah, I would encourage everybody to watch the Final Four. It's been some good games. Let me know what you think about Burke. I'm not saying that I'm always right. I see a guy that I think is fantastic in college, a lot like Jameer Nelson was fantastic in college. I don't see him being able anywhere near Chris Paul. I think that's kind of insulting to Chris Paul, but you know, let me know what you think in the comments, and sure we'll be talking much more about him as the draft gets closer.
So thanks everybody for listening to In the Know.
in the party town. Ain't nothing but a party.